Augustine was convinced that the God who asks us to believe that he has sent his Son to redeem us is the same God who gives us the brains to glean some understanding of that mystery. So when the Manichees promised that they would treat him as a reasonable and intelligent adult, the young Augustine found that promise irresistibly appealing. And we owe it partially to the Manichees that the heart of Augustine's own philosophy turned out to be one lifelong effort to reflect on the religious faith that was in him and bring it to the level of understanding. His personal brand of philosophy is intensely religious, even mystical in flavor, but his religion will never demand consent to any proposition which violates philosophical good sense. But there was a second facet to the Manichees' appeal, and it also sprang from their reliance on the power of reason. They claimed that they alone could make sense of the whole array of evils that human beings encounter at practically every turning of their lives. Their favorite question to Catholic Christians was this: whence do evils come? That question, the Manichees were convinced, would infallibly point up a devastating weakness in the Catholic position. On the face of it, they were right, for Catholics insisted that the New Testament grew out of the Old and is continuous with it. Hence, like the Jews, Catholics believed that the same one God created everything, visible as well as invisible, bodily realities as well as spiritual. Did their God then create such harmful creatures as the scorpion, the asp, the mosquito? What utter impiety, the Manichees thought. What sheer blasphemy to accuse the good God of having created such obviously evil beings. Augustine assures us that precisely that pious conviction had induced him to believe in the fundamental cosmic dualism the Manichees propounded, a dualism of good versus evil. Later, he came to see things otherwise.
They are not healthy-minded, Lord, who object to anything you have created, just as I was sick-minded in objecting to many things you had created. And because in my mind I refuse to consider my God objectionable, I refuse to admit that you could be creator of anything I objected to. That was why I wandered off to embrace the theory of two cosmic substances. But I found no rest in that theory. Only raved madly on.
Madness, he came to think of it. And yet for some 9 years, from age 19 to age 28 or 29, Augustine believed that there must be two distinct and opposed cosmic principles. One is responsible for everything pure and good, the other for everything vile and evil. The Manichees imagined their principle of goodness as having been originally a serene expanse of pure and beauteous radiance. This goodness was a sea of light, stretching infinitely in all directions but one. It was blocked from expanding in that one direction because of a turbulent, horrid, and smoky darkness, a strident confusion of beings, ugly, misshapen, and furiously jealous of the light. That race of darkness, they explained, had once upon a time invaded the realm of light and carried off into this lower realm those sparks of the divine light which are our souls. Augustine later charged the Manichees with thinking of all this carnal-mindedly, that is, drawn from the senses. Because of their materialism, their confident solution to the problem of evil was riddled with contradictions. Augustine later realized that he'd been unable to conceive of evil in satisfactory terms.
The vision of my eyes was limited to bodies, and my mind's vision to phantasms. I did not know that God is a spirit whose members are not extended in length and breadth, and for whom to be is not identical with having a certain mass. For a being with mass is less in any given part than in its whole, and even granting that it be infinite, it is less in any given part, spatially marked off, than in its infinity. Also, it is never everywhere whole and undivided, as a spirit is, as God is.
The Manichees saw humanity as a monstrous union of soul and body, of spiritual divinity imprisoned in the material body. And the body ultimately derives, like all things material, from the anti-God, the race of darkness. A number of ethical beliefs followed from that Manichean view. For one thing, our souls, precisely since they are sparks of the divinity, are thought to be perfectly innocent of all wrongdoing. If we seem to do wrong, the Manichaeans would attribute those evil actions to our material bodies. It was the body, for instance, not the soul, which yearned for the pleasures of sex. So the Manichaeans could shrug, let the body have its sex. The soul would remain perfectly uninvolved, perfectly innocent of such activity. But two restrictions had to be observed. First, every effort must be made to avoid conceiving children, since procreation imprisons the divine soul in matter for one or possibly several future generations. And secondly, those who engaged in sexual activity could never be admitted to the inner circle of perfect or elect Manichaeans. They were condemned to remain spiritual second-class citizens. In sum, the Manichaeans tried to persuade the young Augustine that conception and procreation were the greatest of evils and must at all costs be avoided, that sexual activity in and for itself had no more moral significance than belching or drinking a glass of water, and yet he could never hope to achieve full status in this religion unless he broke completely with all such activity. If you deliberately tried to poison a young husband's sexual life with equal doses of moral confusion and psychological guilt, you couldn't brew a more toxic formula than Manichaeism. Nevertheless, we know that soon after his conversion to this sect, Augustine fathered a child. We also know that mother and father decided to name that child Adiodatus, gift of God. What does this mean? Sounds like a gesture of defiance to Manichaean teaching, but we can learn more on that from Augustine's mature attitude towards sexuality. Augustine tells us he remained a Manichaean from his 19th to his 28th year. At age 21, his studies were completed and he moved back to his hometown of Thagaste. There he set himself up as teacher of rhetoric. At first, Monica refused to live in the same house with this young heretic. But sometime later, she relented, and the two of them were again united under one roof. It's interesting that we're never told how Augustine's mother got along with the mother of his child. But Augustine does tell us, at some length, of a friendship he formed with a young man his own age. The two became close, but within a year, the young man sickened and died. Friendships would always have great importance in Augustine's life. We can all share his grief at this cruel separation.
This sorrow plunged my heart into darkness, and wherever I looked, I saw only death. My native place was a punishment to me, and my father's house a haunting unhappiness. Everything I had shared with him was now without him, transformed into horrible torture. My eyes searched for him everywhere, but he was nowhere to be found. I hated every place that no longer contained him, nor could any place any longer promise me, "Look, here he comes." I became a mighty riddle to myself, and only tears held any sweetness for me.
Finally, Augustine decided, however illogically, that nothing would help except to flee his native soil, as the prodigal once did. He returned to Carthage and resumed his teaching there. His mother went too, praying and occasionally scheming for his conversion. Augustine's sojourn in Carthage lasted some 7 years. It seems to have been a successful period for the young professor. He continued his readings and prided himself especially on plowing unaided through a Latin translation of Aristotle's Categories. Augustine's Greek was never very strong. He doesn't seem to have studied Aristotle in any greater depth than that. Augustine won a prize in a poetry competition and even produced a little book on aesthetics. Its title, On the Beautiful and the Fitting, De Pulchro et Apto, points to the central distinction around which the work is built. That distinction would become important for his later thinking.
I saw that even in bodily realities, it was one thing to be a whole, as it were, and for that reason, beautiful, but quite another thing to be attractive on account of being suitably adapted to another thing, as a part of the body is to its corresponding whole, or a shoe is to the foot.
Augustine is keenly interested in questions about beauty, but he's also sensitive to that disinterested quality, that suspension of self-concern, which theorists through the centuries have proclaimed as beauty's peculiar property. This fascination with beauty will haunt Augustine all his days. We've already seen that he views his return to God primarily as a belated recognition of a beauty ever ancient, ever new. In time, Augustine began to feel some nagging intellectual difficulties with Manichae doctrine. Yet each time he openly questioned some feature of Mani's teaching, he was told that only the celebrated Manichae bishop, Faustus of Miletus, was learned enough to deal with the anomalies bothering him. Faustus had promised to visit Carthage soon, and he finally did during Augustine's final year at Carthage. The Manichaeans had claimed they wouldn't ask Augustine to believe anything they couldn't make clear to his reason. That claim, he'd begun to suspect, was ringing hollow. Augustine's suspicion hardened to certainty once Faustus opened his mouth. Augustine tells us,
"I found that he was pleasant and charming in his manner of speech, and quite able to chatter away on the topics the others usually spoke about, only more agreeably than they could. But my ears had their fill of such things, nor did they seem better to me because they were now better expressed, nor true because elegantly expressed."
Augustine found the dear bishop to be personally attractive, a charming speaker, but definitely a second-class brain. Augustine gave up all hope of resolving his intellectual difficulties, and from this moment his allegiance to Manichaeism was broken. His quest for understanding had been frustrated, first by the fundamentalism of the Catholic clergy, but now, far more disappointingly, by the very sect which so confidently trumpeted its promise of reasoned certainty. Augustine's need for clarity and certainty had always had, and would continue to have, something anxious, perhaps even obsessive about it. It seemed to spring from some reservoir of insecurity deep inside him. But now, where in the wide world could certainty be found? The philosophies of his time didn't seem to offer much promise. Plato and Aristotle had died over 6 centuries before, and an undistinguished procession of lesser lights had taken their place. This situation left the Latin-speaking world of Augustine's time with a choice between Epicureanism, Stoicism, and Academicism. The Epicureans, who were convinced materialists, taught that the main business of human life was the search for pleasure. The Stoics were materialists as well, but they emphasized every person's duty to live by the dictates of universal reason. In desperation, Augustine began to consider the only alternative he was yet familiar with.
"In fact, the thought even came to me that the philosophers called academics might be more prudent than the others, for they held that everything ought to be considered doubtful, and judged that mankind could lay hold of nothing that is true."
Now in his 29th year, Augustine decided to leave North Africa and try his luck in Rome. He no longer believed in Manichaean teachings, but he didn't hesitate to profit from their political connections, both at Carthage and in Rome. Through their influence, he got a post teaching rhetoric at the very hub of Latin history and culture. But Augustine lasted only 1 year in Rome. It was a year of illness and disappointment. That year wasn't a total waste, though. He managed to catch the eye of Symmachus, the prefect of Rome, just when Symmachus was looking for someone to appoint as municipal rhetor at Milan. Soon Augustine was on his way to Milan with the appointment in his pocket. The move was fateful, or, as Augustine would put it, providential.
"I came to Milan, to Ambrose the bishop, known to all the world as one of its finest men, and your devout worshipper, Lord. All unknowing, I was led to him by you, so that through him I might be led, but this time knowingly, to you."
During these years, the emperor of the western part of the Roman Empire held court in Milan. Constantine I, famous in history as the convert who became the first Christian emperor of the Roman Empire, had divided the empire into eastern and western divisions. He then went off to rule the eastern division from Constantinople. This left the western emperors free to move northward from Rome to Milan in order to be at closer grips with the troubles the German barbarians were causing on the northern frontier. Those barbarian incursions already heralded the approaching twilight of the Roman Empire. And there were any number of patriotic Romans willing to accuse the Bishop of Milan of hastening Rome's eventual downfall. Ambrose was waging a fierce campaign against the worship of the traditional Roman gods and goddesses. Many Romans believed this would deprive Rome of heavenly protection against her enemies. However much he knew about these frictions, Augustine clearly felt obliged to pay Ambrose a courtesy visit. The bishop welcomed him cordially. Ambrose's kindliness obviously warmed him. Furthermore, Ambrose's reputation as a preacher induced the young professor of rhetoric to come to his basilica and listen to him preach. Augustine tells us that Ambrose made an impression that was the exact antithesis of the one made by the Manichee Bishop Faustus. Here, matter had it all over mere manner.
Although I had no interest in learning what he spoke about, but only in his speaking technique, the things he spoke about entered at my ears along with the words he spoke. I was unable to keep them apart, so that while I opened my mind to take in how eloquently he spoke, at the same time it gradually began to enter my mind how true were the things he said.
Quite in spite of himself, however, Augustine noticed that Ambrose's Catholicism was worlds removed from the anti-intellectual fundamentalism that had repelled him in North Africa. Could it be that Catholic doctrine was not the insult to rationality that the Manichees had persuaded him to think it was? Augustine wasn't ready to go that far. Twice burnt in his quest for truth, he was now thrice shy. Yet he had to admit, Ambrose was demolishing the whole string of Manichee objections to Catholicism, one after the other. Despite his persistent uncertainty, Augustine decided to enroll as a catechumen, a candidate for the baptism he had never received as an infant. So, almost casually, without any fanfare, he returned to the church of his childhood, the Cattolica. This is the spiritual state in which Monica found her son when she arrived in Milan from Africa. Day by day, the message of Ambrose was taking root. Augustine was brought to review his former hostility towards faith and authority. He saw them now as far more reasonable than the Manichees had pictured them.
I was led to realize how numberless were the things I believed without seeing them, and others which had transpired when I was not there to witness them. So many events in the history of mankind. So much that I believed on the word of friends or doctors or various others. Unless we accepted such things on trust, we would accomplish absolutely nothing in this life. And finally, I realized how firmly and unshakably I accepted on faith that I had been born of precisely these parents, something I could not possibly know unless I believed it on the word of others. In this way, Lord, you made me understand that I ought not find fault with those who believed in your Bible, which you have established with such great authority among almost all the nations of the earth, but find fault rather with those who did not believe it.
With two of his friends, Alypius and Nebridius, Augustine discusses their common quest for truth and certainty. Perhaps it occurs to them they should at long last heed the urging of Cicero's Hortensius. They should forsake their care-ridden lives of worldly activity and form a small community devoted to the philosophical way of life, a life of peaceful study and contemplation. But in that case, how could Augustine support the wife he feels he can't live without? How could he provide for his children? His need for a woman, he perceived, kept him tied down to the busy life of action. It blocked the fulfillment of the dream that had haunted him since his 19th year. Still, he couldn't suppress that dream to embrace the contemplative life. Meanwhile, Monica went quietly to work. She found a well-born Milanese girl of nearly marriageable age and pushed through the arrangements betrothing her to Augustine. This bride would be a more suitable partner for a brilliant young man with her son's promising future. Far more suitable than that undistinguished commoner who'd borne his child. So one morning, Augustine wakes up to find his companion of 11 years has been persuaded to leave her child and disappear in the direction of her native Africa. Augustine describes the incident with disconcerting vividness.
When my accustomed bed companion was torn from my side, as representing an obstacle to the marriage, my heart, to which she had become attached, was torn and wounded within me, and left a trail of blood. And she, meanwhile, had departed for Africa, vowing to you, Lord, that she would never know another man. Nor would that wound of mine, inflicted by the cutting away of my former companion, heal over. Rather, it became inflamed and terribly painful, then gangrenous. The pain became a freezing pain, as it were. But all the more desperate for that.
There's surely something heartless about this entire episode, but almost certainly the heartlessness was not principally Augustine's. And yet, in spite of the very real pain, the sorrow this separation caused him, Augustine's such a slave to lust that he persuades another mistress to share his bed. His prospective bride is still too young to marry. Meanwhile, Augustine continues to wrestle with a skein of intellectual problems that have been tormenting him for years. The first of those centers on the question of what must God be like.
I no longer thought of you, my God, in the shape of a human body, but I did not know how else to think of you. If I tried to think of something lacking all spatial dimensions, it seemed to me that nothing, absolutely nothing, remained, not even a void.
Next comes the nagging question about the origin of evil.
I still could not find any clear explanation of where evils came from. I had been told that our own free will is the cause of evils we commit, whereas your righteous judgment causes the evils we suffer. I applied my mind in an effort to understand this, but I could not make it out clearly.
Augustine has heard Ambrose offer suggestions on many of these issues, but he's still unwilling to embrace any of them without reservations on Ambrose's authority alone. On the other hand, Augustine has no reasonable challenge to Ambrose's answers. He was once hostile even to the idea of accepting things on faith alone. Now he believes that accepting the teaching of some authority figure can be legitimate, maybe a requisite first step towards the certainty of reasoned knowledge. But he still respects the Manichee attitude to this extent. He needs to be assured that he can take the propositions Ambrose is asking him to believe and transform them into propositions he can say he genuinely knows. Suddenly, in his 32nd year, Augustine found the ways of thinking he hoped would help him transform belief into knowledge. He acquired a number of books. They were written, he tells us with maddening vagueness, by Platonists, followers of Plato. He describes the dramatic effect of these readings when writing to his former patron Romanianus.
Then, lo, certain books, brimful of wisdom, as Celsinus puts it, wafted the perfumes of Araby over us, and let drop on our burning hearts the very fewest drops of their priceless unguent. Incredible, Romanianus. The result was incredible, surpassing perhaps what you yourself might believe about me. What more can I say? Those drops ignited a conflagration in me which even I would have thought incredible.
Generations of scholars have quarreled, as only scholars can, about the identity of those Platonists. The most reasonable consensus is that Augustine read Latin translations of treatises written by the prince of Neoplatonic philosophy, Plotinus. Plotinus had taught and written in Rome more than a century before. Some scholars would add the name of Plotinus's pupil, editor, and publicist, Porphyry. But most of these scholars would agree that Augustine read Porphyry's works in addition to some of Plotinus's. However they differ on these details, scholars are virtually unanimous on this much. First, Augustine's writings, even at their most religious, are regularly influenced by Neoplatonic thoughts. And second, Augustine clearly believed that on the whole, Neoplatonism provided the best philosophical categories available in his time for understanding the truths of Orthodox Christian faith. One should, of course, avoid the temptation to read into Augustine more Neoplatonism than his writings warrant. But we would be equally deceived to think that Augustine considered Neoplatonic philosophy and Christian faith as opposed to each other. Until now, almost all the philosophy Augustine had encountered was thoroughly Romanized. This was his first direct contact with a stream of authentic Greek thinking. Neoplatonism emphasized the mystical side of Plato's thought. It proclaimed insistently that humans once dwelt in the contemplative bliss of the higher spiritual world Plato described so enthusiastically. We are really souls who've somehow fallen into this bodily world of our present experience. The all-consuming aim of the wise man's life is to become purified enough to return to that vision. Augustine recounts the fruit of his Neoplatonist readings in the seventh book of his Confessions. He first outlines certain features where Neoplatonic teaching agrees with Catholic teaching. He then notes other elements where it falls short. Augustine wants to describe the tremendous profit he drew from reading the Neoplatonists, but he first warns believing Christians to read the Neoplatonists as he, of course, had done, with a suitably critical eye. First, he describes the state of intense recollection the Neoplatonists required of their disciples.
Admonished thence by those books to return to myself, I entered into my inmost being. I entered, and with the eye of my soul, I saw. Vidi.
I saw. Augustine uses several other terms as well. He saw, that is, he beheld all reality with the inner eye of his mind. He also came to know something, something that became manifest or plain to his intelligence rather than to his senses. He no longer needed simply to believe in the reality he saw, to accept its existence on the authority, say, of Ambrose. He's claiming to have crossed the frontier from faith to reason. He's come to understand. He's attained the certainty for which all through the years he so ardently longed. Philosophers have helped him arrive at this series of insights, but Augustine boldly quotes Paul's epistle to the Romans in order to claim that Paul was referring to the same sort of knowledge.
I marveled that now it was you I loved, Lord, not some phantasm in your stead. I was perfectly certain that, from the establishment of the world, your invisible characteristics are glimpsed, understood, through the things you have made.
Augustine's writing as a bishop. After years of hindsight and theological reflection, he's telling us how he understands now all that happened to him some 10 years earlier, in A.D. 386. But are his confessions consistent with the account suggested in his earlier dialogues? Recent scholarship has made it ever clearer that those two accounts, earlier and later, exhibit some differences in emphasis, and yet they're remarkably consistent with one another. To test that consistency, consider the picture presented by Augustine's earliest writings. Some months after he first read these Platonic books, Augustine and several of his pupils and intimates retired to Cassiciacum, to the country villa of his friend Verecundus. There he began writing that series of philosophical works which would be called the Cassiciacum Dialogues. The first of these dialogues significantly boasts a double title. It can be read either against or about the academics. If we compare these opening paragraphs of the Confessions with the arguments in that dialogue, it soon becomes plain that the later account is in many respects simply a distillation of the earlier dialogue. But the young Augustine's strained attempts at subtlety can sometimes camouflage the parallelism between the two accounts. For instance, he opens his dialogue in the Academics by asking his companions whether humans should be content with merely seeking after truth, even if they never actually find it. Young Trigetius answers,
"We want to be happy, surely. And if we can arrive at that reality without possessing the truth, then we need not seek for the truth."
Augustine replies,
"But what of that prior question? Do you all think we can, in fact, be happy, even if we have not found the truth?"
Initially, this sounds like a purely philosophical question, but terms like seek, find, arrive ring distant bells. Augustine hopes his readers will remember the Manichaean interpretation of Christ's saying, "Seek, and ye shall find." To the Manichaeans, this saying urged believers to move beyond blind faith and seek for reasoned certainty. Augustine's eyes on his former co-religionists, and his questions a frankly religious one. But Augustine has mixed the metaphor of seeking and finding with another favorite metaphor, that human life is a journey. In this metaphor, the act of seeking becomes one of following a way or road, so that finding occurs when the traveler arrives at the destination he longs to reach. As the dialogue advances, however, the plot thickens even further. We discover that Augustine's also thinking of the Christ of St. John's Gospel, who tells us, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." He delights in the paradox contained in this text, that the eternal Son of God the Father, utterly spiritual truth, has entered our temporal world to become an embodied way, the way to himself as the fullness of truth. But Augustine reminds his readers that taking the first step along any way may require that we take the ultimate risk of believing.
"For I hold that one can go astray, not only by following the wrong way, but also by not following the true way. Imagine two travelers heading for the same place. One of them has decided to believe no one. The other is entirely too credulous. They come to a crossroads, and our credulous traveler asks a shepherd, or some rustic he sees there, 'Tell me, my good man, which is the best way toward such and such a place?' The reply comes, 'Go that way, and you'll not go astray.'"
But this traveler's distrustful companion refuses to take the word of any peasant. He stays rooted to the spot and watches with skeptical amusement as the first man heads confidently on his way. As things turn out, this path does eventually lead him where he wants to go. Let the Manichaean and the academic skeptic make fun of this credulity, but think, Augustine asks, which of the travelers reached his destination. But if the Christ of the Catholica is Augustine's way to truth, how does the way relate to the way the Neoplatonists have shown him? He answers that question only in the closing pages of the dialogue entitled Against the Academics. But the answer is anticipated at the climax of a companion dialogue, On Happiness. There Augustine labors to prove that human happiness lies in our finding, that is, arriving at a direct vision of the truth. To Augustine, this truth is the eternal Christ. But that Christ is one person of the Christian Trinity of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So Augustine writes that in beholding the divine Son, we shall, by the same token, behold the eternal Father. This vision, moreover, will be accorded us through the working of the Holy Spirit. In the Confessions, Augustine deploys this Trinitarian symbolism even more boldly. The eternal Christ represents the truth, God the Father represents eternity, and the Holy Spirit represents divine love. So he describes the supernatural light he glimpsed at Milan.
"Whoever knows the truth knows that light, and whoever knows that light knows eternity. Love knows it, O eternal truth, and true love, and beloved eternity. You are my God, and I sigh for you day and night."
But both in his Confessions and his early dialogues, Augustine is convinced that the kind of genuine knowledge which is marked by unshakable certainty can be found only in the mind's recognition of necessary connections. 7 + 3 not only does, but must equal 10. Augustine has come to see that up to now, he'd thought knowing must be an act of sense perception. He'd assumed, like the Manichaeans, that knowing must always have as its object some bodily, physical reality. This had led him to conclude that nothing could be real unless it were material, extended in space, and perceivable by the senses. Even if we succeeded in imagining some immaterial and non-extended reality, it must literally be a nothing or no thing. But at Milan, he came to see otherwise.
"And I said to myself, truth cannot be a nothing, can it? Just because it is not spread out through finite or infinite spaces. And you shouted from afar, 'Entirely true, I am who am.' And I heard with an interior kind of hearing, and there was no longer the slightest reason to doubt. In fact, I could more easily have doubted my own existence than the existence of truth itself."
Platonism has always challenged materialists, those who rely uniquely on sense perception, by pointing to examples of mathematical and geometrical realities. To cite Augustine's favorite example once again, if you understand what the terms mean, you can't help seeing with your mind's eye that 7 plus 3 necessarily equals 10, or that a perpendicular drop from the apex of an equilateral triangle will necessarily bisect the base. A moment of reflection tells you that you see these truths precisely because of the nature of the realities you're mentally contemplating. Your conclusions are not based merely on your subjective way of seeing, but on the objective essences of the realities your mind is considering. The necessary connection in such a case is an objectively real connection. But this could not be true unless the connected essences were themselves objectively real. They're neither bodily nor extended, yet they are realities. Augustine would claim that our knowledge of them is even clearer, firmer, more indubitable than our knowledge of any bodily realities could ever be. The skeptical academic would object that the entire sense world may be something we only seem to perceive. The whole sensible universe may be nothing but the product of our dreaming or an insane delusion. Augustine replies,
I still say that the entire bodily mass or mechanism in which we find ourselves, whether we be sane or mad, dreaming or awake, is either one or many. Show me how that opinion could ever be false. For if there be one world plus six worlds, it is clear that there are seven worlds, whatever my mental state may be, and I can affirm that I know that much, with no fear of being overbold.
All through his early dialogues, Augustine exercises his readers' minds with such mathematical insights. But similar insights can be gleaned by contemplating non-mathematical realities. In taking this tack, Augustine actually anticipates the same move of the mind involved in René Descartes' famous phrase, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Augustine concisely describes this tactic in his much later work entitled On the Trinity. Notice that he argues from the knowledge of our interior states, whereby we know, for instance, that we are alive.
We have no fear in a case like this of being deceived by some false appearance or other, because it is certain that even he who is deceived must be alive. The knowledge whereby we know that we are alive is an interior kind of knowledge, where not even the academic can say, perhaps you are sleeping, and this is not knowledge, but only a dream vision.
Like any typical Platonist, Augustine refuses to fight philosophical skepticism by defending the idea that our sense knowledge is trustworthy. Now he tells us why.
Surely everyone knows that the things we see in dreams are very like the things we see when awake. But the person claiming that he is certain that he is alive is not making the claim, I know I am awake, but the claim, rather, I know I am alive. Whether awake or asleep, therefore, he is alive. And even sleeping and seeing in dreams is the work of a living being. He who claims to know that he is alive can never, therefore, either lie or be deceived.
Activities like doubting, dreaming, or being deceived all necessarily suppose that the doubter or dreamer must be alive. Augustine's so certain that this necessary connection must be true that in his Confessions he goes a remarkable step further. He asserts that the existence of truth itself is more certain to him than the truth of any individual fact, even the fact of his own existence. Augustine's convinced that no individual fact, like his own existence, could be true unless it shared in truth itself, the all-embracing truth he identifies with God. All this was implicit in that summary we heard earlier, where he speaks of truth in this loftiest sense.
And I said to myself, then truth cannot be a nothing, can it? And you shouted, and I heard with an interior kind of hearing. And there was no longer the slightest reason to doubt. In fact, I could more easily have doubted my own existence than the existence of truth itself.
At this point in his argument, we recognize that Augustine is applying the traditional Platonic doctrine of participation. This doctrine says that any individual instance of truth, goodness, or beauty must have received that truth, goodness, or beauty from an absolute truth, good, or beauty. This absolute source transcends, that is, it exists beyond or above the realm of space and time we normally experience. This doctrine of participation now permits Augustine to synthesize the Christian and Platonist views of truth. These views earlier had seemed to be two distinct and unrelated ways of seeking after truth. But now it's clear that if the God of the Catholica is the creative source of everything true and good and beautiful, then that same God must be identical with the absolute truth, goodness, and beauty that Platonists have always looked for. Just such an otherworldly truth, goodness, and beauty had been suggested by Cicero's Hortensius, which long ago fired Augustine to pursue truth with all the ardor of his passionate nature. Augustine believes his conversion at Milan was the long-delayed fulfillment of that first conversion, which occurred 13 years before, when he was 19. So we find him using again the same rapturous images and near mystical enthusiasm he remembers from that time.
Up, Lord, arouse us, call us back to you, enkindle us and bear us away. Be flame and sweetness to us. Let us love, let us run. So did I burn to follow.
But there was an important difference between the earlier and the later conversion. Cicero had summoned his readers to philosophy. This philosophy, in the meantime, had become for Augustine a far more incandescent, more intensely religious reality than Cicero himself could ever have imagined.
This is the end of take number one on St. Augustine. The presentation is continued on take number two.